welcome to the first of a series of podcasts from the British Texel Sheep Society. My name is Andy Frazier, and in this series we'll be looking at the 50 years, yes, 50 years of the British Texel Sheep Society.
During these few episodes, I'll be introducing a new
book commissioned by the Society.
It's coming out this year, celebrating that 50 years of the Texel sheep being in the UK. And I'll also be talking to some prominent Texel breeders, both past and present, about the early days in the Texels and the middle days and the highlights and everything that went on during this 50 years of this great sheep breed being in existence in Britain.
I've got with me John Yates, CEO of the Texel Society. And John, you've been there a while, took over from Steve McLean, big shoes to fill. Steve had been in there a while before you. You walked into the Texel Society with your eyes open, and a lot's happened since then, John.
Yeah, I mean, breed societies are fairly formidable organisations to lead, if I'm honest. They're heavy on politics because they're membership organisations. I never sort of hesitated in taking up the opportunity to, you know, get an interview, and I was over the moon to actually be offered the job. That was what, 16 odd years ago, and you're right, you know, Steve McLean had done a terrific job. So, you know, trying to look at it at the time of, well, where could I take it to another level? Because at the time, you know, everyone felt that it really was going to start to plateau out. Birth notifications were plateauing. Basco had been launched, and really, I suppose from Steve's point of view, it was job done, move on.
Okay.
I was wanting to come in and sort of think, well, like, how can I make a difference? And, you know, where that was really was, you know, using, you know, what was 18 years worth of agri-tech knowledge, having worked for Edinburgh Genetics, SAC, and then CBS Technologies, and then Innovis. And then I had a short stint at National Federation of Young Farmers prior to coming to the Texel Society.
Okay.
But to me, it was quite strange. It was I was in my comfort zone of working in the sheep industry, but I was moving into what was really a people business rather than a sheep business. And I've enjoyed every minute of it. Don't get me wrong; it's hugely challenging. It's hugely stressful. There's huge amounts of expectation from, you know, 2,500 odd members, with 200 new members coming in, you know, every year. There's a fair bit of churn still coming through, which brings, you know, new investment and new opinion and new politic to deal with at the same time.
Sure.
It was huge opportunity, really.
We'll go back to hearing a little bit more from John in a minute, but let's just rewind a little bit to the origins of the Texels and hear a little bit more about where they came from.
The Texel sheep breed originated in Holland on the small island of Texel, about 100 kilometres north of Amsterdam. The actual origins of the Texel breed itself are vaguely unknown, but it is supposed to have been bred up from the Lincoln long wool, the Leicester and the Wensleydale, which of course were all mainly long wool breeds. But by the turn of the 20th century, the animals had established themselves as a lean and muscled meat breed, which had spread across Central Europe. One of the first guys in the breed would be veteran breeder Jimmy Warnock. And I spoke to Jimmy, and he picks up the story of when the Texels very first got mentioned in the UK.
Jimmy, you started the Watchnower flock in 1974, and you're also on a council member on the Texel Sheep Society. So you're right from the very beginning, Jimmy. You've got you know more about the beginning of the Texel than many people that are around today.
Well, I think there's maybe one of the few originals that's left, but in actual fact, it was quite an interesting start in the Texels because we had greyface ewes at that time, which is the borderless across blackface, and we had one that was a persistent prolapser. So I decided to take her away to our local abattoir, which is W.K. Jackson's abattoir at Symington at Bigger. And when I was there, Bill Jackson told me the story that he had followed a load of his chilled carcasses out to the Rungis market in Paris to see why he was never getting the top greys and therefore not the top prices. So when he was out there, he discovered that all the top greys and top prices were going to Texel cross lambs. So he came back here and he went to Lanark market on the Monday, and he met up with Ian Johnson and Jock McGregor of Boghouse and Bog Hill Flocks. And he said to them, look, boys, what you need to do is get some Texel sheep in here to try and improve the carcass quality of the lambs that I'm buying off you at the market. So they decided then they would set up the Texel Sheep Society.
Robert Laird of the Camwell Flock and a current council member and chairman of the Breed Development Committee picks up the story. And as with a lot of these imports, it was a light-on moment, wasn't it, Robert, that sparked the phenomenon that we have today?
Well, Bill had an insight to what the market in Europe was, and he had seen these better-shaped lambs, and he just felt the stuff that he was getting through his slaughterhouse wasn't good enough for the export trade. So he felt that the breeds here could be doing me a bit of continental influence to make them better for export.
And he must have talked a good story, because the two of them bought it straight away, and they coupled with a chap called Sandy Grant, who was perhaps a college advisor of some sort, was he, Robert?
Yeah, well, I obviously had maybe known about them as well, maybe been in previous trips to Holland, perhaps, so there was a bit of a tie-up, and of course, I think we had some continental cattle in at that time, so, you know, the penny was beginning to drop that, you know, that there was a continental sheep, you know, that was going to do a job.
And I know it's an old saying to say the rest is history, but it really is history 50 years on that the Texel breed is the number one breed in the UK, if not the world. And we have a fantastic history collated together of this breed from then until now. And that story will continue with a précis of Sandy Grant's book that he wrote on their 21st birthday. I think Jimmy Warnock had commissioned them to write a book on the 21st birthday of the breed up until that time. And then since then, in our new book, I've précised a little bit of that one, so we've got that history of how the breed came in and where it went from those days when Bill Jackson came back shouting from the rooftops about this fantastic new opportunity. The new Texel history book has been written between myself and Jonathan Long. And together we tell a story of how Bill Jackson and Sandy went out to those early days and encountered a few problems with Maida Wissner and air traffic control and various things in an interesting story till eventually we get to around about 1974 and a consortium of breeders are pulled together and they get their first imports of Texel sheep where they had to draw those out of a ballot. The first four UK members of the society were Jock McGregor, Andrew Barr, Ian Johnston and a chap called Jimmy Lindsay. And those guys are sort of number 1, 2, 3, 4 on the team sheet, as it were.
Robert,
let's talk about this first import. They brought in 13 rams and 26 Gimmer lambs in January 1974. And I believe the society allowed 2 Gimmer lambs and 1 tup per breeder. Is that right?
More or less.
And they weren't a huge investment for these guys. We're probably looking at 200-300 quid a piece.
Indeed, I think it would be along those lines anyway.
I won't name all the breeders in that original consignment that came in there, but just to mention that, Robert, your father at Camwell would be one of those very first.
Yeah, well, I think that there was obviously a wee bit of a bust up in an early committee meeting, and there was still a vacancy there for some of the sheep that had already been selected. So Jimmy Minto, who was probably only about 4 miles from here, knew that my father used to show carcasses at the local abattoir at the Christmas show, so he knew he might be quite interested in something that was going to have a better carcass, and my father jumped at the chance of getting involved in this importation, and it was really a bit of luck.
Had he seen them? Did he know anything about them at all? Was that just him going
on faith? I don't think so. Whether he had been to Will Jackson's open day the year before, it's quite possible. No doubt he would probably have supplied him with fat lambs at some point, but I would have thought he would have done some research, I would have thought.
And Will Jackson's abattoir was only just up the road from you, was it not?
Yeah, it was in Symington, yep.
And Will Jackson would be one of the reasons why Lanark was, and probably still is, home to the Texel breed. I mean, he was there were the guys that are all around him, so you have to give this guy a lot of credit for this. Of course, the flock book started in 1974, as did the society, but some of those animals coming in would have been a bit older than that, so they'd get an earlier letter, and it had been earlier ones still being brought in through Ireland. So I think the time we got to 1974, the naming convention would start with the letter D. Is that right, Robert?
73 would be C. I think they wanted to keep the A's and the B's so that 71 was A and 72 was B. I think they would probably keep it that way.
That's right, then. The first registered Texels in the country would be start with the letter D. Okay, yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. Let's look at some of those early imported rams, then. I've got a tup here called Camwell Constructor was an import. And yeah, tell me about him.
The tups were all drawn out the hat, and I'm not sure which breeder it was, but there was a tup that escaped a couple of days beforehand and had ended up getting a barrel load of feeding, and it was not looking that well. It was a wee bit off colour. And whatever breeder it was that drew that top, hadn't had worked with sheep before. So my father had offered to swap his top for that top, because my father was a sheep man and he knew how to turn the sheep round. So,
very noble of him.
So basically he took the top, and he probably knew what he was doing. It maybe was a better top than he had, but it turned out to be a great move, because Constructor can be found in an awful lot of pedigrees of some of the best sheep that are in the breed. He was from the Gurney flock, and we had one ewe from Gurney, but there was quite a lot of those early imports in Lanarkshire all were from Gurney or Plus P. And those were the two flocks I would say that we did really well, especially from the Annan flock, the Plus B. And
moving on, looking at those exports, one of the older breeders, or dare I say a veteran breeder, was Doug Nesbitt from the Olwent flock, who again started in the 70s there. And I had a word with Doug, and this is what he had to say.
So, Doug, you started the Olwent flock way back in the 1970s, and Texels were fairly unproven back then. What made you go into Texels?
Well, I had one or two Ile de France sheep, but when I saw some Texel sheep on the French stand at the Royal Show, I was immediately converted to Texels. Okay. And bought a Texel ram for ordinary crossing, and then the results were good, so I went over to Holland and bought some males and females.
And you started, I think, more with Dutch Texels than French Texels. And there's quite a different type of sheep, weren't they? They still are, I suppose, to a point. But the Dutch Texel would be a much more musclier sheep. The French Texel, which a lot of the flocks were based on, of course, would be a little bit leggier and maybe not quite so thick. Would that be right? And you would been an advocate of recording and figures recording. And I think, hadn't you been in the pig business before that? Because that's all about recording, isn't it, pigs?
Yes, it was very important in the pig business. But towards the end of my involvement in the pig business, it was starting to be taken over by the big commercial firms. Mm-hmm. And, the smaller man was losing out. But I thought with the sheep, there's an opportunity to use recording in there. Mm-hmm. It's the way I thought it was likely to go.
Okay, and as I said, yourself and obviously a band of you that decided on the recording, but I think you probably led a lot of that forward, and things like the sire reference scheme and all those all came into being later on, but by then you'd already have a ruck of figures. And were you working with your own recording to start with, or did you go straight in working along with the likes of Signet and such like?
Oh, I would do some my own recording first, and when the Signet things came along... I'm a big believer in it, but you have to obey the rules and not try to cheat the system by treating some sheep different. If you start cheating the system, the only person you cheat in the end is yourself.
There you go, some wise words of wisdom from a veteran breeder.
And how did the Texels compare to other breeds, particularly the Dutch ones that you brought in, with regarding growth rates? I mean, I don't suppose you were recording... scanning back then, it would be all about daily weight gain. But how do they compare against other breeds like the Suffolks and maybe the Charolais as well?
They needed more growth rate. Growth rate was behind the Suffolk. It was something which we had to improve on. And one thing in the early stages, for 2 or 3 years, the Texels got a bit of a bad name, because what had happened, people were buying a Texel ram and they were selling sons of it as Texel rams, which were only half Texel. Mm. And a lot of those weren't good, and I think the breed slipped back slightly then, until there was more Texels in the country and people could afford to pick the right ones.
I went on to discuss the grading up register in a little bit more detail with Jimmy Warnock.
And Jimmy, I mentioned the grading up scheme. Of course, that was something else, that using these rams that we were producing, or you were producing half breeds, and then keeping the females and then running those into three quarters, and then eventually up to I think they had to be 90%. So it's six generations before eventually those became pure. So it was a long time, but there was a market for a lot of those early crossbred grading up ewes, wasn't there?
That's exactly right. And we were quite fortunate in that we set up a classification scheme, as we called it, in the society, and I was involved in that in the early years. The late Henry Griffiths was the classifier, okay, and Stevie Williams down in Wales. Mm. And the various parts of the texel were divided into points. So there was points for the head, the shoulders, the back, the quartern jigget, the feet and legs, and the wool. And I always remember it was very interesting when people looked at the scoring system that 25 of the 100 points were awarded to the quarter and jigget.
Yeah, I've got that right in front of me.
That's the most important part, yeah. So I think the classification scheme did us a whole lot of good. And people chose their original breed to cross with the Texel on the sort of growth and the skin and the style of the Texel. So we had a lot of half-bred sheep that produced Texel cross lambs and graded up rather than black faces just to get the carcass right.
I think that was actually a good thing, wasn't it, that everybody had the choice of what they were going to use, so they would be Cheviots and, as you said, Border Leicesters and Blackies and all sorts of different sheep all put into the mix there to see which one graded up the best. And of course, one of the other controversial things about the Texel breed, which stands it apart from many other breeds, was an early ruling that they brought in to say there was to be no dressing. And again, I spoke to Jimmy about those early meetings and what happened and why that one came into being. Who was involved in making that rule, Jimmy? Do you remember?
Well, I was on the council when that rule was made, and it was quite interesting. There was two objections from notable outstanding breeders and other breeds.
You can name and shame, Jimmy. Name and shame.
Can I?
Go for it.
one was the Youngs of Skillington Mains, another one was Bill Weir of Wheatrigg.
Okay.
And they were both Border Leicester people. Mm-hmm. And you can understand why they were against these rules. But the rules were made by a new breed society that had no history to follow. Mm-hmm. So they could make the rules and make sure that they were adhered to. So the rules were: no feeding, no colouring, and no dressing. And it's very hard to produce sheep without one, two, or even three of these.
Mm.
And I always remember at one of the society sales, the early society sales, there was a big dispute over sheep that were darker skinned, they were browny in their fleece, whereas others were white. And this was down to the type of ground that they were farmed on.
Of course.
Nothing to do with the man colouring them. So it led for a lot of interesting discussions regarding whether the sheep had been tampered with or not. but I think that the rules were good, and I'm delighted to say today that there's still no dressing. I know there's feeding, and I know that there's colouring, but I'm delighted that there's no dressing in the Texels.
So we heard Jimmy Warnock there speaking about the origins of the Texels and the rules that they put in place. But of course, not everybody was convinced. The Texels still had a lot of marketing to do, and one or two of the more traditional ones there weren't quite convinced the breed was ready for the market. A while ago, I spoke to veteran breeder Keith Jameson, and Keith talked about his pal Robin Hope, who went on to be one of the great breeders there, of course, at Kirtle. But he said in the beginning, his pal took a little bit of convincing, I think.
Robin Hope, he was the top of the Cheviots.
Aye.
And he used to come down, or I was up there every other Saturday night. And when he was at Woodhead, he always wanted to go through the sheep.
Right.
And I don't know how many Saturday nights when we went through them, and Robin Hope would stop and say, "No, I didn't ken where you're going with these sheep." So anyway, the time went on, and there was one Saturday night later on, and he stopped and said, "I can see where you're going." And that's when he bought his first Texels off us.
But while some people weren't so convinced, there were those that were entrepreneurs that could see this as a way of making fast money. And Robert tells the tale of one such chap from the Isle of Man.
It goes back to this Kenna flock. Now, I'd never really heard of the Kenna flock. And I did a wee bit of research. And basically, it was a Scottish businessman from London that owned a string of casinos in Iran. And when the Ayatollah took over and the revolution came on the scene, he had to make a quick exit. So 2 hours to get out of Iran, apparently, and he only grabbed what he could grab. And so basically, he obviously quite liked the idea of going to Isle of Man, as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. So he obviously had a farm there and decided to invest it in some textiles. So he headed off to France in 78 and bought something like 83 females and 22 males, which was a phenomenal import when you think about it. The following year, he would lamb those ewe lambs, and then he would maybe sell them in maybe either 1980 or 81 as a dispersal at Banbury. And that is where this female line that the Cowell boys have done so well with has come from.
But although some of the early textiles did come in from France, we mustn't forget their origins in Holland. And I spoke to Stuart Curry about where his father and himself started the Butry flock in Settle in North Yorkshire.
I mean, your father would be the obviously in the
dad
beginning
was in
there.
The start, yeah, yeah, he was early days, like 78, 79. Mm-hmm. And he was actually a local vet down the road that had one or two in his field, and that's how it all started.
Oh, really? Okay.
A chap called Bill Semple.
The early sheep that your father brought in, came in from Holland rather than France?
Yes, they came in, several came in from North Holland and several off Texel Island itself.
Okay.
And we would originally buy a couple off Peter Dixon Smith, who would bring an importation and sell them either off farm, or then he'd put some through Banbury.
Okay, he was bringing in quite big numbers.
He was bringing quite a few in there, yeah. We ended up fighting against Caroline Hastings and the likes of Caroline to get the best ones when they came in at the time.
Mm-hmm. But the majority of the Texans that came into the country were French. We've sort of discovered that. But there's still the Dutch influence was the one everybody wanted because the Dutch sheep had a lot more shape to them, didn't they?
They had the shape and they had the skins. Mm-hmm. I think that's really where it worked with us. That we got a fantastic ram off Keith Jameson. Alan Jaguar was the first ram that we got. Mm-hmm. And he was obviously pure French bred. Mm-hmm. Been on a double diamond son, and he clicked wonderfully with the Dutch sheep.
Okay.
So he actually put the power of the French, but maintained the skin of the Dutch and the carcass of the Dutch, and that's really where we sort of hit the jackpot because we couldn't go wrong with that cross.
And did you carry on bringing them in some later on?
Yeah, we sort of get another importation a few years later, which was, I think, probably was more diluted then, and the Dutch had tended to sort of keep some of the better ones back then as well. They never clicked the same as those first few, the North Holland ones in particular. Jaguar was our first ram, the first crop off him, Molotov Cocktail, went to Lanark and he took the tray that day at 4,500.
Right, okay.
And that was sold to John Marshall Lambert.
Okay, yeah.
John bought that, so that put us on the map to start.
Sure.
And then we did ever so well the following year. That's when Beauty Nazarov came along, and he was the same way breeding.
Yeah.
It was Jaguar cross.
What did Nazarov make?
Was it 7.5?
Okay.
Nazarov went down to John Mellin at Hull House and John Norcross.
Oh, right, okay.
Skirbeck.
Yes.
They bought Nazarov.
Okay. Of course, they showed him, didn't they?
Yeah, because they showed him, and he'd win the championship at the Royal and the Yorkshire Show. But he was a perfect example of that Dutch cross, French breeding that kicked out so well.
I chatted to Di Clark about the beginnings of the Garngower flock and the Woodlands flock through his father, Jim.
Yeah, Dad was one of the first, I think he was nearly teen numbers. He was way back through Jock McGregor.
Mm-hmm.
Jock was the first one, got him back. And I mean, Dad always saying he nearly got killed with his mother when he spent, I can't mind exactly what it was about 400 or 500 quid for these two gimmers that come home. Selected picked, and then it went, I think they sold their first Shetland Duck for about 800 quid the first year at Woodlands.
For a minute or two in this episode, we'll skip forward to the now and go back to that conversation that I had with John Yates and how John extolled that the breed membership almost fell into two different parts, being the commercial side of it and the pedigree breeder side of it. So John's going to bring us up to date a little bit about what the Texel Society means and what it actually does.
I've tried to focus on, I suppose three strengths, and those strengths are really, we need a healthy organisation, number one. So, those that know me, I'm very process driven. So really, to me, it was finance is so important, because if you haven't got financial health within it in the organization, you have instability, you don't get confidence. So that was the first thing to sort of ensure that we've got that robustness within the organization. And you know, that app has to be complemented with other key points, which is communications, promotions, and marketing, and the technical side of breed development and R&D. That has to be gelled together with good governance and a cohesiveness of that opinion that comes through those 13 directors. So getting that framework in place, and obviously, you know, there was a fair degree of that framework already there, but refining that and making sure that we're clearly focused on why does Texel matter, what matters for Texel members, but more importantly, what matters to commercial producers that use Texel, and ensuring that we continue to grow that understanding is very, very important.
Okay.
You know, the shows and sales side of things, that's the easy part, if I'm honest. So, you know, running the organization to get a high price Texel is not really a challenge. High price Texels, continue to flow through. What is important is making sure that the 11,000-12,000 animals that we catalog every year, you know, ensuring that we've got the right services in place, the right support mechanisms in place for members to allow them to develop their flocks, but also sell animals out of their flocks. That's where the challenge is. So heavy on politics, as in every breed society, but making sure that we've got the nuts and bolts in place. You know, as they say, devil is in the detail, Andy, and there's plenty of detail in Texel to ensure that the organisation delivers.
John and I continued to discuss the commercial aspects of the Texel sheep, of which, of course, everybody finds very important. And it took me back to thinking about the conversation I had with Doug Nesbitt, going back to those early years, and Doug's idea of the difference maybe between the pedigree and the commercial sheep of that time.
You would have built up slowly, I suppose, or quite fast, one of the highest index flocks in the country, and around about 200 ewes. And how hard was it to convince customers that figures were the way forward? Customers, I suppose, buying other Texels from you, that figures were the way forward rather than people buying with their eyes?
Well, if I was selling any rams to people who kept pigs, it was quite easy. But there's the believers and the unbelievers. And a lot of them... the younger people always went more in figures, especially those that had been through an agricultural college or university trained. They were much more believers in figures.
Mm-hmm. And when the figures first came in, the Cygnet figures, did they marry up, or were they an antagonist to the figures of your own? There, did everything sort of all knit nicely into place?
No. I tend to believe them. I had to, adjust as some things are, which had to change when the weight at which these measurements were taken was a thing which was looked at much later and was causing problems.
Okay.
And about IMUS and things like that.
And the eye muscle depth.
Of course, yes, as you said, depending what day it was taken, that would make a lot of difference, wouldn't it? And then they would adjust it by days, I guess, but it would still vary from animal to animal, wouldn't it?
Yes. But I still think the eye muscle area was very important, mm-hmm. you know, for the depth of loin, and is probably missed a little bit today in the general run of things.
Is eye muscle still not recorded these days? I suppose it is.
Oh, it's recorded, but I'm talking about the non-recorded people.
Okay.
And
it wasn't just about the figures, though. You used to show your sheep as well and win a lot of shows, too. And was it hard to get the right sheep with both the figures and the breed attributes, such as head and breed character, to get that balance between them?
No, I think it was probably easier then than it is now.
Okay.
Because the commercial sheep, the one which was doing well, we were breeding that type of sheep, but now there's a big difference between the so-called in italics pedigree sheep and the commercial sheep. Mm. They're drifting apart a bit.
Some slightly controversial words there from a veteran breeder, but I took the subject to Robert Laird, the subject of performance recording and the importance that was put upon it right from the beginning and the trials that went along with that.
So let's just talk about the progeny testing that was done by the society. It was a lot of it, wasn't it? There was a sire reference scheme, and the elite Texel sires would be the beginning of the blup figures, wouldn't it? So the figures started with Texels, really, would that be right?
Yeah, I think so. In those early days, those mid to late 70s, these early Tupsil came into the country, where they actually went to did a progeny test at Bog House, and it was Kenny Johnson's father, Bob, actually, that managed it for quite a number of years. So that would be the set, the kind of foundations for the recording system that we kind of have now in a lot of ways.
And you'd be in that from the beginning as well, though. You'd have born
We were always quite keen to make sure. Jimmy Minto was a great figures man, and he was adamant that we should know what we've got. That was the criteria. You always know what you've got in front of you, so you know where you want to be.
Sure, and yeah. What you can see on, rather than seeing with your eyes. And we've had this discussion in various other breeds. And would I be fair to say that the Texels led the way on figures? I don't want these angry Suffolk and Charolais breeders phoning and throwing mud at me. But they did have a recording. They set up the flock down in West Wales, didn't they? And
that's right.
The whole thing
I think they were just lucky that the Texels had the numbers. They had the flocks that were interested in recording, so they had a great nucleus, a great flock of sheep to record from, and if they've got numbers, you've got data, and then you can start doing comparisons and stuff like that.
How did the sire reference, or the elite Texel sire, should I say, how did that work? They just used to all turn up on a farm with your best sheep, and then somebody would select the ones they wanted to put in the scheme?
Well, I think in those, from the ones I can remember going to, basically you took what Tucks thought were good enough. If you were good enough to use in your own flock, you would take them to the open day, and they would all be voted on, and there would be half a dozen were maybe selected, and basically every member of the group had to use probably two of those sires. Didn't matter which two they were. And that gave you a bit of a common link, and it was this linkage that gave the accuracy to the figures that they came up with at the time.
So back then, that would be just based on an 8-week weight and a 21-week weight, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
There wouldn't be any scanning back then, would there?
I don't think that the earliest scanning, I think that it's probably about 30 years ago, the start of the back fat scanning, I would think. 1990-ish, I would have thought, like, that was a big difference, because you could actually see in front of you on the screen the differences in muscle depth. It was fantastic. It was recording. There's a lot of flocks went down that road solely on recording, and there was other flocks.
Back then, a lot of these breeders, like Steve Smith and Charles Scott, would be the drivers behind that. But didn't it get the sheep a lot bigger? Didn't they start to get the sheep bigger because of the figures?
Oh, there's no doubt about it. At that time, the figures were orientated towards growth. And some of these guys that were using figures, high index, they got some massive ewes. And probably the borders where Charles Scott was, and a number of breeders like your Richard Oates and Arnold Parks for that area, they did a great job in promoting the Texel elite sires. It was exciting times, probably.
Exciting times they surely were. When documenting 50 years of a breed, of course, we've got to look at those milestones that happened along the way. They say behind every good man is very often a good woman, and very often it is those early females that made their mark on the breed that bred some of these high-priced animals. So we're just going to take a look towards the end of this episode now at some of those earlier females that had such an impact.
In the second importation in the back end of 74, there was a ewe. She was a gimmer by that time. Boghouse Daffodil, she was named. And she, in 1979, bred Boghouse Ian, and sold for $13,000 to the McEros. In 79, that was a big trade. I can remember one of his sons, I was at a stockist in the Stonefield Hill, and there was a top called Groutfoot Jungle Boy that Ali Brown had bought. And I can just remember him and no more, and he was a tremendous muscle sheep and a big square top with a tremendous depth, and I think that would be the top that would be behind a lot of the fat stock shows that, you know, both McEro and Alec Brown would promote in the Texels in those early days,
yeah.
You know, so it's incredible the offspring that can be descended from that ewe.
Stuart, you and I mentioned Annan Jaguar early on, and he went on and bred really well for you, didn't he?
With a cracking female of him called Beauty Margaret, and she won the championship of the Yorkshire. And it was the very first sale we were getting off the ground at Chelford for the North West Texel Breeders Club.
Okay.
So it was their inaugural sale, and Dad was actually the chairman of the club.
Okay.
So he just thought it right to put in something good on that day, and of course, so he insists on putting in this show. the show beast.
So it was,
yeah,
while,
and that was the first sale there. She made 8.5 grand, which was then a world record for female sheep of any breed.
Okay.
And of course, females from Keith Jameson's Anne and Flock, whenever they came up for sale, were always in top demand.
1988, we sold 80 Texels, the average 1,000, and they were ewes, gimmers, and lambs.
All right. And Keith, later on, after Robin Hope died, you shared a gimmer sale with his dispersal, and I was at that sale. They were a great trade. I was trying to buy a few myself.
That's right. Was it 94?
I think, maybe.
I hadn't any prices on that year.
I can tell you the prices because I wrote them all down because I was trying to buy them, Keith, and they were too dear for me. The top. I remember Albert Howie coming to me before the sale and saying, "You've got a few Texels." He said, "Tell me which are the best ones." And I went back through your families because I knew a bit about your breeding families. And there were two sheep in there. The one went back to the original Woodhead ewe of yours. And I can't remember the other one, but he bought those two gimmers, one for 3,500 and one for 2,800. And that's what started Albert Howie going with the knock flock of Texels. His first ones. And as the breed progressed through the next 50 years, there were more records, male records, female records, world records, continuously being conquered. And as mentioned previously, the book we're writing will document those milestones with details and with photos, early photographs, and of course later photographs covering the wonderful achievements and the transformation that the Texel breed has undergone during these 50 years. And there'll be words of wisdom and snippets of information from interviews, some not heard before, with some of those great people that shaped the Texel breed. You take a lot of credit, Keith, for being one of the original founders in the Texel breed. You're still known as Mr. Texel to all of us of our generation. And I think the breed would be a poorer place if you hadn't been involved in it, to be honest.
No, I've certainly enjoyed it. And I've met tremendous lot of friends. I think that's the big thing about it. And I've certainly enjoyed it. Both my late wife and I. And Margaret, she had every catalogue from day one, the prices of
marked
the
up, yeah.
Lanark,
yeah.
And the name.
So fantastic to be able to hear the likes of great breeders like that. And the book documenting the history of the Texel breed over the last 50 years should be available through the Texel Society offices from round about autumn of this year, 2024. That concludes the first of four podcasts that will be coming out over the next few months as we lead towards the celebrations and towards the launch of this new book there. So listen out for the next one as we move forward through the decades there and publish some interviews we've done with some of those great people that have helped shape the Texel breed over the last 50 years.